From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
David Petraeus, Paula Broadwell, and you. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The affair that ended David Petraeus' career has demonstrated the vulnerability of all Americans to government cyber spying. Under current law, there's no expectation of privacy for email or other telecommunications which go through third parties like Google or Facebook. The Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search does not apply, creating the potential for abuse by government agents. Can the law catch up with technology? Or has the U.S. already become a surveillance state? On Reporter's Notebook later on, trying to save Twinkies and 18,000 jobs. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The incident that forced a CIA director to resign is being cited as evidence that technology and laws passed since September 11th are turning the U.S. into a surveillance state. Why don't constitutional protections apply to email? What's the role of Google, Facebook, and the cloud? On Reporter's Notebook, Hostess Brands and its union have agreed to mediation, but it may be too late to save a small industry based on Twinkies, Ding Dongs, and other confections. First, this news update. As we began broadcasting and recording this program just moments ago, there was hope that the hour for a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel had arrived. Ashira Frankel is based in Jerusalem for NPR and the McClatchy newspapers. She joins us from the border between Israel and Gaza. Ashira Frankel, welcome.
Hi.
What signs do you see that a ceasefire might, in fact, be in the works?
Well, the signs that we're seeing are all from unnamed reports by Egyptian, Palestinian, and Israeli officials saying that a ceasefire deal is close. Here on the border, though, it doesn't seem that close at all. I don't know if you can hear some of the bangs in the background of it I speak to, but that's outgoing Israeli artillery fire being aimed at Gaza. Tonight, we've seen the heaviest sort of artillery shelling of Gaza, and we've seen quite a few rockets coming from the Gaza Strip into Israel. Earlier today, there was a home in Rishon LeZion that was hit. That's a suburb of Tel Aviv, so those rockets are reaching really deep into Israel. It's clear that both sides are going to continue exchanging hostilities until that ceasefire deal is announced.
Does it appear, though, that the Israeli soldiers in that area where you are have relaxed somewhat in the past few hours?
The infantrymen have certainly relaxed. There's tens of thousands of soldiers here, and their presence is everywhere. You see them along the streets at the bus stops and in the cafes. And they certainly seem less on guard than they have been in the last few days. If you had asked me 48 hours ago, I would have said that they were on the highest state of readiness. We saw them with their guns strapped. They were sitting in tanks. I mean, clearly they were ready to roll into Gaza if the order was given. Now they're a lot more relaxed. They're pulled back from the border. They're calling home. They're making weekend plans. It's clear that at least on the part of the IDF soldiers, the infantrymen I'm seeing here, there's no plans for an expanded Israeli ground operation at this point.
There have been reports that there were Arab diplomats in Gaza visiting with Hamas leaders today. Were you able to see any sign of that?
I was not in Gaza today, so I didn't see them myself. I spoke to people in Gaza and interviewed several members of that delegation who said that they were there to show support of Hamas and of the Palestinian people. I think what's interesting, what's significant about that delegation is that it signifies something much larger. It's sort of the Arab world support of Hamas as a group in charge of the Gaza Strip. We've seen the first sort of diplomatic outreach towards Hamas just a few months ago with the Qatari and Bahraini government sending envoys there. Now, in the last week, we've really seen that sort of support expanded. Egypt has stepped up and shown its support of Hamas, and it seems like Hamas has really sort of achieved a new standing in the Arab world.
Ashira Frankel again at the Israel-Gaza border. Thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Let me turn now to Tel Aviv, where Avi Isakharov is a correspondent for Haaretz. It's good to have you on our program as well.
Good evening.
What are you hearing? From our standpoint, it's been back and forth for some hours now as to whether the ceasefire might actually occur very soon.
Actually, I've heard a couple of contradicting reports coming from Cairo and coming from Israeli and Palestinian sources, meaning at least till 7:30 p.m. Israel's watch, meaning an hour and a half ago, I did believe that there will be a ceasefire announced this evening. But since then, I've spoken to some Egyptian sources in Cairo who told me that they are still waiting for the Israeli side to sign this agreement or to say yes for the ceasefire agreement. And this is the reason that there's not going to be an announcement tonight, and maybe only after that the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will arrive to Israel.
So she has left Asia, as we understand it, and has been dispatched to Egypt after President Obama spoke with President Morsi of Egypt and also with Prime Minister Netanyahu. How important a role do you think the United States is playing?
I'm not that sure that the States has a major role here in the negotiations, but I guess that this is something of a more symbolic role, that maybe the Egyptian president wants to see Hillary Clinton coming to Cairo, blessing the president, the new president, blessing the Egyptian regime, and giving a kind of a green light to the agreement that will be signed between Israel and Hamas. And this is a very important agreement, we have to mention that, because according for what it is, for the target of this agreement, well, it means a truce or quiet on the border between Gaza and Israel, not for a week or two, but hopefully maybe even for years. This is according to our Minister of Foreign Affairs, Avigdor Lieberman. I doubt if this is going to be the case and this is what will happen, but at least the agreement is supposed to bring quiet.
All right. It's a little after 9 o'clock in the Middle East as we speak, 9 o'clock in the evening. And we will all hope for a satisfactory resolution of this sooner rather than later. Again, Avi Issacharoff with Haaretz in Tel Aviv. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, David Petraeus, Paula Broadwell, and you on To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. An FBI agent told superiors that his friend Jill Kelly was subjected to email harassment. The subsequent investigation did not uncover a crime, but it ultimately forced David Petraeus to resign as director of the CIA. The incident demonstrates how vulnerable innocent Americans are to invasions of privacy by government agencies. Declan McCullough is chief political correspondent for CNET. Good to have you on our program.
Hi there. It's a pleasure to be here.
We don't really know, as I understand it, if the FBI got a search warrant under the Fourth Amendment, which requires that in order to avoid unreasonable searches. But as I understand it, they don't need a search warrant in this case. Why is that?
Well, it's an interesting situation. And you're right that we don't know all the facts yet. I mean, it's still early on. There'll be congressional investigations and things will come out over time. But the interesting thing is that General Petraeus would have actually had more privacy in some ways if he had stashed those love letters under the mattress. And that's for two reasons. The first is if the FBI wants to get those mattress-stashed love letters, they're going to have to execute a search warrant. They're going to have to go before a judge and get a warrant backed by probable cause. This is a very old standard. It's privacy protective. It's actually in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. And second is that they'll notify you. There's a legal requirement that you're notified, and also if your front door is bashed down with a battering ram, that tends to be a bit of a hint. But neither of those two situations is true when it comes to email. Now, the Department of Justice, and this is a bipartisan, long-standing argument. It's both the Bush and Obama administrations have argued that they don't have to notify someone if they get their email, if it's stored on Gmail or Yahoo Mail or whatnot. And the second is that for draft email, the Justice Department and FBI's position is that no warrant is required. They should just be allowed to get it because it hasn't actually been sent. And that's the technique that Petraeus apparently used.
You mean they didn't send the messages after all?
Exactly. I mean, this is what's been publicly reported so far, and I think we'll learn more over time. But the idea is that they would Petraeus and his paramour would edit a draft message on Google Docs so it didn't actually leave Google servers. This has been used by other folks before to conceal their communications, but you know, it doesn't always work that well as we've seen in this case.
What about the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which was passed, as I remember, in 1986? Why doesn't that require a warrant?
Well, this goes to Congress's tendency to write legislation that's kind of technology specific. I mean, back in 1986 when this was written, we were talking about a black and white Macintosh SE or Macintosh Plus, the analog modems, BBSs maybe, but certainly not the commercial internet that we know and more or less love today. So the wording of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act is confusing, and but what it does, but one thing that it does not do is require warrants for email in all circumstances. And there's a legislative push in Congress to fix that. There are a bunch of tech companies, Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, Twitter, pretty much all the big folks, trying to say, look, let's fix this, Congress, because if you don't, then who's going to use this wonderful cloud computing service that we've put together? Instead, they'll just store their email on the hard drive or print it out, and we can't have that. So there is this push. There's a vote in the Senate Judiciary Committee next Thursday to move the bill along. I had an article up on CNET this morning saying that the bill is actually now privacy invasive. There's been some last minute changes, but it's something that's right now in flux in Congress.
You mentioned Google, Facebook, and others. They are what are referred to as third parties. Why is it important that third parties are involved with regard to email and other electronic communications?
Well, if you print out those love letters we were talking about earlier and put them under your mattress, there's no third party involved. If someone wants to read those, they're going to come right at you with a search warrant if they can get it. But that it requires a bit of work on the part of police. They have to actually go before a judge and get a search warrant. But in the case of internet communications, mail that's old and cloud storage or Google Docs or Facebook posts in your timeline or Twitter direct messages and Google or Picasa photos. I mean, you can imagine how all the stuff that you're probably already storing, and if not, you're going to be doing it in a few years the way the industry is going. They don't need to currently get a search warrant for all of this data. There's a move afoot in the courts to try to update the Fourth Amendment to the digital age, and the Sixth Circuit, which is Ohio and Tennessee and a few other states, said, oh, well, actually, sorry, FBI, a search warrant is required, but this is just one circuit, and we've got a lot of others that's not the law of the land, and so that is what has led these groups into left-right coalition and libertarian coalition in Congress, including the ACLU, Americans for Tax Reform, and so on, to try to get Congress to enact a federal law that would increase, on a national basis, privacy standards.
Declan McCullough, again, is chief political correspondent at CNET. Julian Sanchez is a research fellow at the Cato Institute. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
You have used the term surveillance state to describe what's going on in the United States. Before we get to that, let me ask you to pick it up where we just left off with Declan McCullough. When something is stored by a third party, be it Google or Facebook or Amazon or the cloud, where I guess they're all storing stuff, apparently all the government has to do is go demand the information from that entity. Is that correct? And you're not protected.
That's right. Yeah, there's a series of increasingly outdated Supreme Court decisions from the late 1970s in which the court decided that any time information is held by a third party, like your bank or your phone company or Google in this case, you have, they say, assumed the risk that they will then disclose that information to someone else. So your information in their hands is now treated basically as just part of their corporate business records. And you have to understand, this made a little bit more sense in the late 70s. One, when storage was very expensive, so the amount of sensitive information about you that a corporation would keep in its records was pretty minimal. And also when a third party having your records usually meant a human being was actually looking at those records, as opposed to they're being stored in a vast server somewhere. And so that gave rise to what's been called the third party doctrine, which is really almost universally regarded as wrongheaded by Fourth Amendment scholars, but has become the basis for the very weak protections afforded to this kind of data, even where in some cases statutes or other courts have provided somewhat stronger protections.
And just let's make sure our audience realizes exactly what does the Fourth Amendment say and what protection does it offer?
Right. So the Fourth Amendment, of course, says that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. And now we understand papers to mean, of course, the digital equivalent of what it meant in the 18th century, shall not be violated, and that no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the things to be seized. And in fact, when it comes to phone conversations, the Supreme Court has said in a 1967 case called Berger v. New York that for wiretaps, actually even a higher standard is appropriate, not just probable cause, but because, they said, a phone conversation wiretap goes on secretly. You don't actually go to the person's door and show them the warrant, but you're secretly wiretapping them over a long period of time, that additional requirements were appropriate because you didn't have the same kind of checks and balances in place during the actual search. It was more like a whole series of searches that would expose the intimate conversations of lots of people. And so they said, actually, to get a warrant in that case, one, you have to show what's called exhaustion, meaning you have to show that this is really the only way you can get the data you need. It's not, there's not a less intrusive method you could use. And also that they have to engage in what's called minimization, meaning essentially not recording innocent conversations. If you're wiretapping a mob boss, you don't keep recording when his wife is calling up her doctor. Those arguments, every argument for the additional protections there, actually applies far more to email, because unlike a wiretap where perhaps you're listening to someone's phone line for 30 days or 60 days, access, as in the Petraeus case, to someone's entire email account can reveal years and years and years of intimate conversations, intimate chats over a service like GChat. Also, you know, if it's the entire Google account, perhaps their search activities to give you a hint about what they're reading and what topics they're looking for. And of course, it's equally secret. And in this case, if they actually get a warrant, as it seems they probably did actually in the Broadwell investigation, but if they get a warrant, they don't even need to tell you after the fact that they've done it. So if Broadwell had not been speaking with, or had not been sleeping with the director of the CIA, it's entirely possible that having determined that these emails didn't constitute a crime, were not prosecutable, that they could simply have refrained from ever telling her that they had read her emails.
Is there any way to stay ahead of the technology? It seems to me that the law is behind the curve in that regard. Is that really what we're dealing with here?
Yeah, the law made, again, more sense in 1986. So, for example, there's a structure in the Electronic Communications Privacy Act that provides relatively high protection, that is, say, at least a search warrant for the emails sitting unopened on the server, and they're treated basically exactly the same as a phone conversation when they're actually moving over the wire in transit. But then that protection is lost once, at least according to the DOJ's interpretation, once you've downloaded and read your email, it's no longer being stored as sort of just in the just for the purposes of transit, and you also lose it if it sat there for 6 months or longer. And the rationale behind that, again, in 1986, made a certain amount of sense because the assumption was space, you know, storage space is expensive. A megabyte of storage was like $100 in 1986. So the assumption was you were going to connect, download your email, and then really read it on your home computer, where it would have Fourth Amendment protection, just like the rest of your home has Fourth Amendment protection. And so that assumption, of course, goes out the window as storage gets cheap. Third parties are storing more and more sensitive data, and that loses the protection it previously had. If you want to stay ahead of the curve, there are things Broadwell and Petraeus probably could have done to keep their stuff more private. They might have used a software called Tor to hide their IP addresses so that it was harder to trace back to the origin who was actually using these accounts. And they could have used encryption to make it harder to read those messages. This saving messages as drafts techniques really provides almost no protection at all, in isolation. But there are things that people can do to stay out of the curve until Congress wises up or the courts finally get around to deciding that the Fourth Amendment is not a dead letter when it's digitized.
But anybody listening to this program could be subject to an investigation without knowing it. If they become suspected of something, or if they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, because you can be followed, of course, from place to place on your cell phone. And there's no way at this point to protect them from that.
Yeah, there's not much to do about that, certainly. Again, the location tracking is something else that was not really conceived of in 1986. There was a very vague tweak made in the early 90s saying there's a certain weak authority that can't be used all alone to track someone's cell location. But as more people use cell phones, more and more cell towers are placed, especially in cities, to deal with the increasing quantities of data traffic, your cell phone really does provide an incredibly detailed kind of virtual map of your physical movements over time. And again, as storage space gets cheaper and the cell phone providers have their own reasons for storing this information for to maintain their networks and do traffic analytics, the ability to subpoena that information to get that kind of virtual map becomes far more broad and easy. Certainly, actually, if you are involved in some kind of intelligence investigation, you don't even need to be suspected of wrongdoing, and no kind of court order is required. After basically pledging to eliminate the use of what are called national security letters to spy on Americans who aren't suspected of a crime, they reached really an all-time high in the first year of the Obama administration. More than 14,000 Americans had their sensitive financial and communications records seized using national security letters just in 2009 alone, and that actually is a tally that does not even count what are called basic subscriber record requests, which can actually also be pretty revealing. It would have been basic subscriber information that revealed, for example, what IP address Paula Broadwell was using to access Google, and therefore effectively strip away the anonymity of that anonymous Gmail account. So that number is probably vastly, vastly larger. We know, of course, that the overwhelming majority of people who are investigated using national security letters are not at all involved in any kind of wrongdoing. It's a tool that the FBI uses very early on in investigations to check out not just the person they're interested in, but everyone who is in communication with that subject. And often it's just someone that they've got a random tip on. You know, someone says, "Well, my neighbor looks awfully Muslim, and perhaps you'd better look into his activities." And so they, don't want to be accused of ignoring leads, and so very broadly investigate any tip they get, whether it's that well founded or not. So that's data that even if you are absolutely innocent, there's no sign that you're involved in any kind of wrongdoing, will sit in an intelligence database for 30 years. And if you think about the FBI's extraordinarily unattractive history of using personal information for political or personal advantage, you have to worry what happens not just during the investigation or in the immediate aftermath, but years or even decades later as people with access to those databases are able to use them.
Julian Sanchez, again, research fellow at the Cato Institute. We're going to take a very brief break, come back and continue this conversation. Why does law enforcement have these powers? Why does it really need these powers? Are they often abused, as was just suggested by Julian Sanchez? We'll hear more about this and how every one of us is subject to the kinds of issues that we are talking about today. And later on, Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk about mediation. Can it save Twinkies and 18,000 jobs? Back in a moment with To the Point for PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warman, only back with To the Point. Is the United States becoming a surveillance state because of new technology, particularly the Internet? Is the law able to keep up with the technology and provide the kind of protections for privacy that are guaranteed by the Constitution? Paul Rosenzweig is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy in the Department of Homeland Security. He's also the founder of Red Branch Consulting, consults on national security and privacy law. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Good to have you, Paul Rosenzweig. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What is the is there a good side of this, the ability of the government to pry, if that's the right word, into very personal kinds of communications from people who are totally innocent and perhaps not even suspected of anything?
Well, I think that your question kind of assumes the conclusion. The good part of this, I don't want to minimize the problems. There are of course potentials for abuse, but the good side of this is precisely the opposite of that. We since 9/11 have been aware of our inability to connect the dots. Many of the tools that we're talking about are precisely the same sorts of tools that we wish we'd used in that context, and we continue to use in other perfectly legitimate law enforcement and national security contexts. The question, it seems to me, I certainly agree that the laws are somewhat out of date. Anything that was passed in 1986 doesn't apply to the computers, the internet world that we live in today. But the question is not one of prohibition, or at least it ought not to be one of prohibition, but rather one of finding a way to manage the consequences of the technology so that we get the bang for the buck, that we enable legitimate investigation and not preclude that while at the same time protecting privacy. For me, the questions are less about the innocents whose email is being scrutinized and much more about what, if any, abusive interest the FBI or any other investigative agency is doing with that. Ms. Broadwell, it wasn't picked at random out of the American populace for investigation. She did something that turned out not to be a crime, but was at least somewhat legitimately a subject of somebody's inquiry. I haven't seen the emails, so I don't know how threatening they were, or whether it was, whether they were manifestly criminal or just deeply concerning to the recipient. But it's not like there's a fickle finger of fate that just randomly and arbitrarily picked her out of the blue.
No crime, however, has been charged as a result of that investigation, but there are all of these various actions that it precipitated. For example, the FBI agent who originally was told by Jill Kelly that she was being harassed by email, apparently got unhappy with the FBI investigation, thought there was a political reason that it was being slowed down, and consequently called a couple of Republican congressmen suggesting, it would appear, to the FBI that there was no question that ultimately this was going to get out, and therefore it did. How would you protect those people from those kinds of consequences?
I don't think that you can. You live in a public world to some degree. When I walk along the street and hop and pop into a porn shop, not me personally, of course, that's subject to public observation. If you act in a public world, that's the reality of what is possible out there. The digital world is, to a large degree, a public sphere as well. If you choose to bail your letters, your private love letters, to take Declan's metaphor, with somebody else and leave them with them, you really have, to some sense, misunderstood the nature of what you're doing if you think that the third party you're giving it to has any legal obligation to keep it private.
But do people really understand that? I mean, there you are sitting in your computer. You're all by yourself, wherever you may be, and you're not thinking about being in a public sphere at all, are you?
No, I think that's right, but that's a failure of public education, right? I mean, that's a failure in our schools, wherever it is that we, and public understanding. But there's lots of things that the public doesn't understand. We have a basic saying that ignorance of the law is no excuse, and yet I have absolutely no doubt that nobody listening to this program knows all of the 4,500 federal criminal laws. That's a rough estimate, not to mention the 30,000-odd state laws that might apply to them. We are obliged, the actor, to educate themselves. That's not necessarily a good thing in all circumstances, but we tend to say in this society that you have to educate yourself to the consequences of your own actions, not the other way around.
Paul Schwarzenzweig, again, formerly with the Department of Homeland Security, now a security consultant. Jim Dempsey is Vice President for Public Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology. That's a Washington, D.C. organization that deals with privacy rights. Jim Dempsey, good to have you on our program.
Warren, great to be on the show. Thanks.
How do you respond to what we just heard, that we live in a public world, that you have an obligation to inform yourself about the circumstances under which you are passing information around?
Well, look, back in the 1870s, the Supreme Court said that your letter is protected by the Constitution. Even though you give it to a government official, the Supreme Court ruled back in the 1870s that the government needs a warrant to open your postal mail. It took them a long time to catch up with technology in terms of the telephone, but finally, by the 1960s, the Supreme Court ruled that your telephone calls are protected, even though they leave your possession, they pass through the network of the telephone company. The Supreme Court said the Fourth Amendment right to privacy protects your telephone calls, and it needs a warrant for the government to investigate, to tap your phone call. Of course, the government has compelling interests. Of course, there is criminal activity, terrorist activity. But the question is, what are the checks and balances? What are the rules? And as Declan said, the rule in the Constitution is, if you want to intrude that deeply onto somebody's privacy, to read their mail, to listen to their phone calls, go to a judge, make the case, get the warrant. It happens thousands of times every day in the ordinary physical world. Now we need to take that same rule and apply it to this new technology. The courts have begun to catch up, but they've been slow, which is in a way the nature of the judicial process. A number of major companies, civil liberties organizations, groups across the political spectrum have gone to Congress and said, Congress, you need to intervene here and make it clear by statute, as Congress can, that the constitutional requirement of the warrant should apply if the government wants to read your email as that email sits with your service provider, as well as your calendar, your documents, the drafts, all of the personal private, not the stuff you've disclosed publicly. We're not talking about Facebook pages here. We're talking about the private stuff that is intended to be private, either it's corporate data, proprietary data, medical data, personal data, intimate stuff. Comply with the Constitution, get the warrant. The Republic will not fail. We've lived under that rule now for 200 years. It's a good rule. That's one of our most important checks and balances. And I think it's time that both the courts and the Congress bring this law up to speed with the technology.
Paul Rosenzweig, what do you say to that? Is it time for that?
Oh, I don't disagree at all. I mean, the laws are anti-privacy. Any set of rules that goes back to 1986 or 1974 with the underlying Privacy Act is woefully out of date with where we are right now. And I would not in the least bit disagree that Congress is free and ought to be free to set the bounds and the balance of what the government can do with this information in this digital age. What I think is probably the break point between my friend Jim and I, and he is a good friend, is that sometimes we disagree about where that balance is going to be struck in particular cases. But that's the basic architecture of a statutory protection is exactly right. I mean, to give a little history, back when this third-party doctrine that Julian Sanchez was critiquing first came out in the 1970s, it related to telephone records and bank records, and declared that you had no rights of privacy in those at all. The immediate reaction of Congress was to pass the laws, the Right to Financial Privacy Act, to try and put some of the protections back. I suspect that some may disagree that they didn't put enough back, but that's the right way to go about responding.
Let me go back to Jim Dempsey at the Center for Democracy and Technology. What about this issue of the government asking Google, asking the others that operate storage facilities where all this information is enclosed? How often are those companies asked for that data by the government, and what do they do about it when they're asked?
In terms of the numbers, we don't have a comprehensive picture. We have little bits of information. We know undoubtedly that the numbers are going up. Google publishes something called their transparency report. To some extent, they were a leader in the industry on this. Other companies are now starting to do the same, showing the number of government requests that they receive and at least showing what percentage of them they respond to. And Google's doing this, by the way, on a global basis. The numbers are going up steadily. We have another data element, which to
So what does that tell us?
It tells us two things. It tells us that the government has caught on. If anything, they were there before the rest of us were, but the government knows what we're all talking about, which is our lives are now online. Any given criminal activity, there is likely to be some evidence about it in digital form, whether that's cell phone location data, information about who was calling whom, stored texts, email, etc. So again, the government has a legitimate, as I keep saying, they have a legitimate need for that information. Question is, what are the checks and balances? And right now, those checks and balances are weak. So the government is going where the evidence is.
Okay, Julian, Paul Rosenzweig, back to you. You talked earlier about connecting the dots and how important that might be in, for example, an investigation of a potential a terrorist act. And speed, no doubt, would be very important to connecting the dots. So do you run into problems then if you try to put limits on what the government can do, when it can do it, and would there be a cumbersome procedure required, or is there some way to speed that up?
Well, that is the argument that the government usually makes, but I think my own view is that we've had in the past, and we should continue forward if we go in this direction, with emergency procedures that allow for judges to be available on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis, and even in really extreme cases, for the government to act first and get the warrant afterwards, and have to justify both the warrant itself and the urgency and exigency of why they took action. To my mind, honestly, that's not likely to be a significant barrier. The only people who would object to that would be, I think, people who can't imagine any emergency at all that would be that would call for some kind of shortened procedures. But I think, in general, we can put in place a warrant requirement or a pre-approval requirement of some sort, and have an emergency exception to that that wouldn't be terribly abusive.
Okay. My understanding is you need to leave us. Paul Rosenzweig, again, formerly with the Department of Homeland Security, now at Red Branch Consulting and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Let me return to Julian Sanchez, who was in the first part of our program, research fellow at the Cato Institute. You mentioned past abuses by the FBI. One thinks of J. Edgar Hoover having information on members of Congress and others in order to get them to do things that he wanted them to do or not do things that he wanted them not to do. What other kind of abuses do we know about that might come up again in this context?
Sure. Well, certainly there's a number of cases in which, and these are documented somewhat exhaustively, although certainly more has come out since then in the Church Committee reports. This is sort of the first major congressional investigation that uncovered a lot of the decades of history of abuse by not just the FBI, but also the CIA and NSA. So certainly you find cases where often, you know, with at least some kind of initial legitimate basis for opening an investigation, you had strategic information that was gained, where presidents learned, you know, what liberal columnists, for example, were going to be saying in future columns. You learned about what Washington players were saying to each other and to Supreme Court justices. I know JFK, in one case, used the information gained from what was, again, initially an arguably legitimate investigation into whether the Dominican Republic was bribing people to try and influence trade legislation, but used strategic information he got from that to shape his strategy. And the FBI internally concluded that this intelligence had been very useful for him in getting the trade bill he wanted passed. LBJ used some of the information gained from illegal wiretaps of Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders to plan his strategy for the Democratic Convention. Of course, perhaps the most notorious case of abuse involved the wiretaps on the sexual liaisons of Martin Luther King. Those tapes were later, of course, sent to his home along with a menacing letter. It seems to have been part of an attempt to drive him into depression, which succeeded, and perhaps even to suicide, which fortunately did not, but part of the larger animosity Hoover held toward King and an attempt to sideline him so he could be replaced by someone more to the FBI's liking. Other cases involve leaking of information to friendly columnists in order to discredit or destroy political figures who the FBI was unhappy with. There have been cases, again, revealed in the Church Committee involving, for example, the sexual misconduct of legislators who had been insufficiently cooperative in terms of getting appropriations for the FBI. And so there was an internal memo that was uncovered where they said that having made a certain senator aware that he had been spotted in a car by a police officer with a woman, not his wife, he was no longer giving them any trouble with appropriations. It's an incredibly long list.
Okay, so we all know then that there's a lot you can do with information, however it is that you come by it. Let me finish where we began with Declan McCullough, the chief correspondent, political correspondent for CNET. What about the comparison between the Obama administration and the previous administration of George W. Bush in this area? And does it suggest, if there's an increase, which I gather there is, that there's going to be more of this, not necessarily abusive, but more gathering of information, more available information as time goes on and as technology develops?
Well, let's see, a few points. The first is that candidate Obama, when he was just a senator, told me personally in an email that he was committed to protecting Americans' digital privacy and would work towards greater privacy protections enshrined in legislation. And you can see that if you search for our 2008 Voters Guide. And that did not happen. I don't know if his administration on these topics is any worse in terms of privacy than the Bush administration was, but it's certainly no better. A lot of this, realistically, is driven by the agencies. It's not coming from the top down. It's coming from the bottom up. You have career staff who really like certain approaches, certain expansions of surveillance authority, and often the folks at the top are going to nod and just go ahead and support it. So the interesting thing is that if some of these proposals had been advanced by a Bush administration, you'd see a lot of folks on the left say, oh, this is Big Brother surveillance state, but because they're coming from a Democratic administration. I'm talking about things like a CALEA expansion and data retention legislation and so on. A lot of the criticism on the left is muted.
Okay. We're going to be hearing a lot more about this as time goes on. This will be our introductory program to the subject. Thank you all very much for being on it. Declan McCullough at CNET, Julian Sanchez at the Cato Institute, Jim Dempsey at the Public Policy, Vice President for Public Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology, and of course, Paul Rosenzweig, who had to leave us a moment ago. Good to have all of you with us. Join us again, and we'll continue this conversation. After a strike by its union, the bankrupt Hostess Brands Bakery announced last week that it was going out of business. Boxes of Twinkies are now up for sale on Craigslist and eBay for thousands of dollars apiece. You know they last forever. But yesterday, a judge asked both sides to try mediation. We'll find out about that in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_kcrw.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. 4,000 people have signed a petition asking President Obama to nationalize Twinkies to, quote, prevent our nation from losing our creamy center. But for 18,000 workers, the demise of Hostess Brands bakeries is no joke. Tiffany Hsu is business reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And Tiffany, thanks very much for being on our program.
Sure thing.
What is the legal situation right now? The company's in bankruptcy. It was it wanted to liquidate itself. Now a bankruptcy judge has persuaded it to go into mediation.
Oh, it's all a big mess.
Sounds like it.
So what the situation is today, a Hostess and its union are meeting in mediation. They're going to try to work through their differences. Just in case that doesn't work, which is a situation that many experts think will happen, the original wind down proceedings are going to continue tomorrow, or they're at least scheduled for tomorrow.
So they've got hours to try to work something out.
Basically.
Now, this is the company and the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union. That's all one union that got together, and they struck. What did they strike over?
They accused Hostess of cutting wages, cutting benefits, and at the same time giving executives at the company nice big fat pay raises.
So have they demonstrated that, or is that something they need to demonstrate to anybody at this point? Or if the company decides to liquidate, is it moot?
I think it's moot. I talked to some experts yesterday who were saying that the mediation actually puts Hostess at an advantage because, let's just say the talks don't work out. Hostess can just say, we're going to close up shop and we'll probably sell at a loss, but then we'll just wipe our hands of the issue. But the union workers are fighting for their jobs at this point. So they don't have as strong a stance.
So does it suggest then that they might have to accept cuts in wages and benefits, even if the executives are getting bonuses?
It sounds like they're probably going to have to make some pretty severe concessions to keep their jobs.
Now, this isn't just 18,000 workers manufacturing Hostess products. There are 565 distribution centers around the country. There are 33 different bakeries and 570 bakery outlets. I suppose some of those 18,000 people work there. But it does seem to me that there is a greater effect than just on those.
Exactly. And then if you look at the consumers that have really taken to social media in the past few days to, voice their disappointment at this. And really, it's almost a level of grief.
Tell us a little bit more about that. What sort of messages are you seeing on social media?
When the news first broke on Friday, it was a level of panic that I really rarely see when it comes to consumer news. People were on Twitter saying, oh, my God, I'm going to have to go into the store, buy up any Hostess product I can see. And then people did that, got into the store, and realized that the shelves were completely cleared. You know, you mentioned earlier that products are being sold on eBay and Craigslist for thousands and thousands of dollars. There are people on Facebook who've created memorial sites for the Twinkie.
Now, there's Twinkies, there's Ding Dongs. What other products does Hostess make or has it made in the past?
They also do Ho-Hos and Wonder Bread. Those are probably the main brands.
And what about people who might want to buy those brands? If, in fact, there's this level of panic, as you suggest, it would seem to me that there might be some value in those brands.
Oh, absolutely. And there's already a list of people who've thrown in their names or have been reported to be interested in buying Hostess or some of its assets. And those include Hearst Capital in Florida, Flowers Foods. There's also Bimbo Group in Mexico, and they own Sara Lee and Entenmann's. And then actually quite a few others who are kind of towing the waters a little bit.
What is the level of panic really about? We know that these products are famously made in such a way that they will last for a long time. But if the company's not doing that well, if it's actually thinking about eliminating itself altogether, are people really still eating this stuff?
It's a kind of a funny point. It's almost like you didn't really realize what you had until you lost it. But you're right. As American consumers look more for healthful foods, premium foods, junk food that has a reputation for lasting past the apocalypse, that isn't all that popular. If you look at the sales figures for Hostess, they're falling, and they have been for the past few years. But what seems to be the case in the past few days is that Americans are looking back to their childhoods where, Twinkies and Ding Dongs played a huge role. It's kind of this feeling of, our childhoods are going away. We're getting older. If Hostess isn't around, then it's a brave new world.
And it sounds to me as if they're going for thousands of dollars per box, maybe people want to buy them to put them on the mantelpiece or put them in their wills to pass them on to their future generations.
It's an investment property. Maybe they'll stash them under the mattresses with the gold bars.
So then the question arises, if in fact the company does go out of business, would these other companies that you mentioned really want to buy these brands and manufacture these things, or would they use the brand for some other purpose?
I had an expert tell me yesterday that you can make a Twinkie anywhere as long as you have the recipe. So it's not really the food product itself that's important. It's the brand. You know, once these companies buy up the rights to, you know, say, the Twinkies logo, they can make a killing off of this if they, you know, if they shrink the size a little bit to conform to new consumer tastes, if they start marketing new ingredients that make it a little more healthful, if they give it better shelf space than it's had in the past years. There's definitely a way to amp up the power of Hostess brands without Hostess owning them.
All right. We will find out relatively soon, it would appear, whether there's still life in Twinkies and Ding Dongs and Ho-Hos and Wonder Bread. Tiffany Hsu with the Los Angeles Times business reporter. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks.
Today's program produced by Caitlin Schamberg with Katie Cooper and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.